Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, best-selling author of The Little Red Book of Selling, wherever that comes in. And I'm joined by the great Jen Gluckow.
Hi, I'm Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute, and this is Sell or Die, a show all about discussing the real world of sales. No bullshit, no tricks, just how to make sales on the street, whether you're in Chicago or Copenhagen.
We call it Sell or Die because you're either selling or you're dying slash dead. There is no in between. Either you're in the groove or the other guy is. And we want you to be in the groove.
We're interviewing the best minds on selling and personal development, and we're going to take your questions. If you have a question for us, tweet us at Gittimer or at Jen in a New York Minute or
and remember,
on Facebook.
Wait, there's no such thing as a stupid question.
Well,
unless it's a stupid question.
Yeah, there is. Okay, or Facebook.com/Gittimer or Facebook.com/Jen in a New York Minute. Use the hashtag sell or die. If you're listening live and have a burning sales question, tweet it to us with the hashtag sell or die, and our wonderful producer, Doug Branson, will get it to us. Hi, Doug.
Hello, Jennifer. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, guys. A reminder to all the listeners out there, you can listen to us live Wednesdays at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time at blogtalkradio.com/sell or die. Subscribe to us on iTunes or any of the popular podcast apps. Just search Sell or Die and have episodes downloaded to your computer or mobile device. Jennifer, Jeffrey, what's going on in your sales world?
Doug, you're going radio on us. I love this.
Professional.
Jen and I met this week with Max Altshuler, a guy we had on the show a couple of weeks ago from the Sales Machine and Sales Hacker. And we have decided we're going to do a couple of public seminars, maybe a few public seminars around the country and in a city near you. It could be Dallas. It could be Atlanta. It could be Chicago.
Tweet us where you want the next show to be.
Exactly. Go to hashtag sell or die.
Yeah.
And tweet it out there.
Exactly. Let us know.
Yeah. We want to come to your city unless it's a goofy city. Coming up, we have a great show. We have our first live in-studio guest, 2015 NASCAR track champion and driver. And right now you all think it's a guy. The number 54 Toyota Racing Camry in NASCAR K and N Pro Series, Julia Landauer, is here. She's part of our series called Profiles in Sales Courage and Just Plain Girls with Balls. Stay tuned for that.
Plus, a lot of young salespeople get into entertainment or ticket sales, but don't get the guidance they need to get to the next level. Jeffrey sat down with Mark Jackson, Vice President of Ticket Sales for NBA's Charlotte Hornets, for some tips to get you through some early struggles.
Okay, Jenny, let's get into it. It's time to sell or die. So just before we get to racing rock star Julia Landauer, I want to tell you about what fuels our engines. Answer, Death Wish Coffee. Like, dude, sell or die, Death Wish Coffee. Get it? But this coffee is way more than coffee. It's the world's strongest coffee, and it's made from the strongest possible combination of perfectly roasted beans, and it's made with a secret formula. Crab. I love secret
formula. You'll
only
get that if you listen to our former podcast. They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee.
See,
go get
bullshit
your first
is like a pervasive word
bag of
the, show
of the
today.
World's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com. Brian Randolph sent me a note that he got it. He listens to us and he loves their coffee.
Yeah, pardon me while I take a hit. So let's start with some listener questions. Every week we ask our friends at reddit.com/r/sales and all of our followers on Twitter and Facebook to submit some questions, sales questions. You can also email us your questions to sellordie@gittimer.com. Doug, first question, please.
First question comes to us from Work for Bacon, a user on Reddit. You gotta love the username.
I love their username.
You gotta work for the bacon.
Go
I like
for it.
It makes sense. All right. Work for Bacon asks, what is your opinion on using a script for phone sales?
It's good for a guideline. It's crappy when you sound like you're reading.
Ever get a call where you can tell someone's scripted? It's
yeah.
horrible. I don't want to talk to them. Do you?
I call them out on it. I go, wow, that's a pretty shitty script you got there.
Do you ever ask them, so what do you have to say if I say this?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, it's pretty horrible. What they do is they prepare a script for you so that you'll sound consistent with all the other people that are behind the phone. And most people that are working in a telemarketing position don't have the creative capability to make their own script up. The problem is the people who make the scripts up don't use the scripts.
Mm.
If I got a script from somebody, I'd say, here, make 100 calls, make 10 sales, and then let me know what happened. And then I'll be glad to make 100 calls and sound like a jackass. So how are you today? I'm fine. What are you selling? Well, I was wondering if I just needed a couple of minutes of your time.
Hang Great. Up.
Yeah, bingo.
Yeah, but I agree with you, Jeffrey. It can be used as a guideline and a tool to help you hone in exactly on what you're going to say on the call.
Would it be advisable to, read it out loud and just make sure that everything sounds like it's in your voice? But how about changing up the script a little bit if you can and seeing if that gets you a few more hooks?
Why don't you read it out loud and record yourself on your iPhone or whatever, voice memo.
We're unscripted.
Listen to how you sound and see if you'd like to talk to the person you're listening to. And then if you don't, re-record it. Try again. Keep
record
practicing.
Record it. Sound conversational or you will die.
Yeah.
I like it. All right.
Practice with a buddy.
All right, next
Any more bacon out there?
No, and this next question comes from a dinosaur, bearded dinosaur,
okay,
the username. How do you go from the, yes, I want to go with your company, to the signature stage if they can't sign that day? This person has done 4 to 5 touches on several clients, and they keep delaying the signing. It's been 3 to 4 weeks and still not a single signature.
Well, if you're on the phone, which it sounds like you are, you need to get an e-signature program so that somebody can sign right away. If they say they're going to go, then let them go. But oftentimes, the guy that says we're going to do this is not the actual decision maker. He has to go and ask his daddy or his mommy, and they say, no, we're not going to do this. And then this guy gets cold feet and doesn't want to talk to the salesperson that he or she committed to.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're at with that.
Yeah, so one of my clients recently had this exact question, and he was having these issues where he would get a lot of yeses verbally and then wouldn't get the signature and would have to follow up, and it was so frustrating. And so what I suggested he do is make it so that he can send them to a landing page when they say yes, and he fills out the form with them, mm-hmm. and then they can sign it right there online. And if you use something like DocSend, you can pull up your slideshow and have it right in front of their face as you're showing it to them, and then take them to another place where they sign.
Is that DocSend.com?
DocSend.com.
Yeah, why don't you go there and see what their offering is, because it is an incredible tool for salespeople.
Yeah.
Not that we're giving them a free commercial. But it's an incredible tool for salespeople. In fact, the CEO of DocSend and I had a conversation. He blew me away with the way he was able to present his information.
We should get him on our show.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for all those great questions. We'll answer more later on the show. If
there's
you're
only
listening,
two of them.
We're going to answer more later.
Oh, okay, cool.
If you're listening live, you can still submit a question on Twitter at Gittimer. Or at Gittimer, or at Jen in a New York Minute. Just make sure to use the hashtag sellordie.
That way we can find them.
Oh, yeah. We've started a series on Sell or Die called Profiles in Sales Courage. It's all about brave salespeople who struggle and fight. They've risked it all in pursuit of their sales dreams.
Ooh.
We've told you the story of Pamela Barsky, who lost her business in an earthquake. So she decided to move to New York City and conquer her retail space.
With little tiny bags.
Oh, yeah. In a 100 square foot factory.
And she's selling zillions of them.
It's amazing.
Yep. We also heard the story of Mike Brown, my buddy, the founder of Death Wish Coffee, who almost ended up homeless, but instead bunked in with his mom, landed a Super Bowl commercial, sold 250,000 pounds of coffee, and has an amazingly successful business and a sponsorship.
So today we're continuing that series with our next guest who's joining us live here in our Charlotte studio. She may be doing the most courageous thing so far. She drives the number 54 Toyota Racing Camry in NASCAR's K&N Pro Series West. She's Julia Landauer. Welcome, Julia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is quite special to be able to do this in my new hometown.
We're glad you're here.
Yeah. All drivers live in Charlotte, don't they?
A lot of them do, and that's because NASCAR's headquarters are here, and a lot of the teams are located here. So if a driver wants to go to the shop, they can easily access that.
You know, in Troutman, North Carolina, you could take on the sponsorship of Julia's Tally House.
Oh, I'll have to go pay them a visit, right? Got to get some of that sponsorship.
Best sales, baked sales. Apple and best fried chicken on the planet.
What more could you want?
Near Mooresville.
So do you eat the chicken first or after?
You kind of eat them together.
As one does.
Yeah, exactly. I want you to understand in the audience, if you're listening to this interview, you're thinking, she's a chick. What's she doing? Selling. She's a driver. No, no. She is responsible for selling millions of dollars worth of sponsorships. If she doesn't win, they don't sell. If she wins, they have a potential of selling.
Yeah, but I don't think a lot of people associate race car driving and sponsorships. I didn't until we met. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, so racing is a really interesting sport because it's half talent and skill and the sport itself, and it's half business. Unlike every other sport, you know, you have to, as a driver or the team, have to sell millions of dollars of sponsorship to make it to the top. Mm-hmm. And so if a driver doesn't come from, you know, a trust fund or really deep pockets, it's up to him or her to really create a brand and provide value to a company, be able to articulate that, and then get people behind their mission and then perform on the track to be able to
win a race or two.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's tough, and you know, a lot of people will hire people to help them do it, but at the end of the day, I am my best salesperson, I've always thought. I convey the passion and the energy and the brand best, and so we've had some pretty good success so far, and it's only going to keep getting better.
But you're a young lady. Great. How many years could you have possibly been driving?
Yeah, so I'm 24 years old, but I started go-karts when I was 10, and it was something me and my sister did together because my parents wanted us to compete head-to-head against boys. They wanted us to be tough. So
cool.
Did that, yeah, and then I started racing cars when I was 13. So I've been doing cars for 11 years now, and so it's really become my whole life in terms of trying to make it.
Okay, wow. So the one question I want to know, what's the fastest you've ever gone?
I've gone 160 on a road course, and so it's left and right turns, but we went 160, and you have to go down to first gear, which is, you know, way slower, and so you just feel the G-forces as you hit the brakes and then come to a stop.
Wow. That's pretty fast, 160. What is the standard NASCAR driver? What do they hit when they hit the straightaway?
So, and the NASCAR drivers at the top level, when you're racing on tracks as high as, you know, 2.5 miles, mm-hmm. they will hit 200 miles an hour. Wow. You know, on my series, which is basically the minor leagues of NASCAR, races on smaller racetracks, but we'll hit 150 or so.
Are you afraid?
Yeah,
cool.
That's a great question. That's a great question. Yeah, I'm definitely scared. I'm definitely scared, and there's a whole lot of the industry that is scary, and I'm actually putting together a public talk about that. But it's the thrill and the excitement of conquering it is way more powerful than the fear. But the fear
title,
keeps you on edge.
You have a book title, Scared Shitless.
There we go. Bestseller. There we go.
Okay, wait. So your parents get you to this go-karting thing. You're going head-to-head with boys or whatever. Mm-hmm. How do you transfer that into, I'm going to be a race car driver?
Yeah, so when I was 12, it was totally an emotional decision. I loved it. I was always happiest when I was at the racetrack. I was proudest of myself when I was winning and, you know, working hard, communicating well with the team, being able to perform on the racetrack, you know, interacting with the fans. It's all so intoxicating, and it puts you on this high, which once you catch that, it's hard to let it go. So.
No, you're 12.
She's interacting with the fans at 12.
No,
I love that.
First of all, it's before the iPhone.
Yeah,
it's before any kind of computer made any kind of headway.
Yeah.
So you're out there as a woman or a young lady, and you're trying to, A, win, and then, B, go to the next thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's this constant growth and constantly figuring out, okay, what do I have to do now to prepare for the next step? How fit do I have to be now to be able to get into the next one? How much money do I have to raise this year to be able to go racing?
And were your parents supportive the whole time?
Yeah, my parents have been super supportive, and I'm very lucky. I understand not everyone has that, but you know, they've also held me to a high standard with great responsibility, and that's part of why, you know, I did my first sales pitch for sponsorship when I was 15, and so
Whoa.
You learn a lot of lessons that first time out, but it's been really cool.
So there's one thing that people associate with racing, and that is the checkered flag.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And when did you take your first I'm sure you remember that, right?
Yeah, I mean, my first win was when I was 11 in go-karts at our local go-kart track in upstate New York. And that's one you never forget. But probably the most powerful win was my first car win. When I was 14, I won the first race of the season in the Skip Barber Racing Series and then went on to win the championship. So getting that first checkered flag was so exceptional. And then my first NASCAR win, which was the beginning of the 2015 season. We went out. I hadn't raced full time since I had started college. And, you know, we go out there and qualified third. And all of a sudden I was in the lead and it was like, oh boy, I can taste it. We got this. And then I got the first win and it was like, wow, this is the season. We're gonna get it. So it was
cool. Okay, tell us about your first sale.
Okay, well, my first unsuccessful sale was with...
That's how it starts, baby.
Yeah. So when I was 15, and it was right after middle school, and Betsy Johnson, the dress company, was one that I just really liked. And so I thought, I really like these dresses. I'm sure they would want to sponsor me because I like wearing their clothing. So I put together a Word document.
Wait, time out. That's ballsy.
Oh, yeah. And this is where my parents like clearly let me learn the hard way, but I told my parents that I was going to do that, and on one afternoon after I had printed out my proposal and, you know, put some pictures in it and put it together in a packet, my dad and I walked down to the Betsy Johnson headquarters. I went up to the receptionist and I was like, hello, can you please give this to Betsy Johnson? And she's like, okay. And that was it. And I walked away. I was like, all right, here we go. I'll expect to call in the next week or two. I'm sure it never left that secretary's desk, but my dad let me do that. And then we debriefed, and then he explained some things as to why it probably didn't work.
Like Betty Crocker, there is no Betsy Johnson.
Yeah, maybe like that. Although we do see her do cartwheels down the runway. They probably don't sponsor NASCAR drivers.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was really cool. But then the first sale that was really successful actually didn't happen until 2015. I mean, there was that many years of... You know, so that's almost 9 years. And so part of it was that, you know, my family had some funding to be able to go racing, and we got in sponsorships, not through my selling, but through a team selling or other things like that. And so I was able to attract the attention of someone who graduated from my high school and had a software engineering company. And, you know, it was through a crowdfunding campaign, but I still had to convince him why he should give me, you know, thousands of dollars to go racing. And kind of we had a couple phone conversations, and he contributed, and it was just really successful because, again, people have been contributing, you know, $10 to $100 or something. So to get someone to really give the biggest amount was really cool, and it was inspiring. We got to put his logo over the front of the car.
Love that.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was just really cool and to be able to show, and then he got to go to his employees and say, hey, we're on a NASCAR car. Like, this is really cool. And we, you know, offered, you know, a high-touch employee engagement of doing a go-karting day. And so that kind of providing value in non-traditional ways was really cool to be able to figure out and then convey to them and get them excited by it.
That's incredible. Did you know him, or were you just able to establish rapport more quickly because you went to the same high school?
Yeah, I didn't know him, but I think once you're part of Stuyvesant High School for math and science in New York, it's a pretty geeky, nerdy, but powerful public school. You know, you have this reputation. You're all part of the family.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about this yet, but as a demure young lady, you were on Survivor.
Yeah. All part of that brand development, right? Help with sales. So when I was a sophomore at Stanford, I got the opportunity to apply for Survivor. I was like, how can I give this up? Like, I definitely want to try it out. You know, a lot of the women who had been successful were total badasses and, you know, super tough and strong. Mm-hmm. And so went through the application
process.
By the
way, you're the skinniest badass I think I've ever seen in my life.
Maybe skinny, but I'm strong. Actually, sidetrack, I got my genes analyzed and I found out that I'm not likely to put on like big bulky muscle, but the muscle I do put on is going to be exceptionally strong. So I guess it's more efficient, right?
Cool. Well, that's
great. Yeah, super interesting. So I'm not getting as frustrated anymore when I'm in the gym for an hour a day and not seeing any big difference. But so I went on Survivor, and it was so tough. I was able to incorporate some of the stuff I knew from racing, but it also taught me a lot. Perseverance was the big one, which definitely helps in every walk of life. Mm-hmm. And I learned
and
that sunscreen's really important. Yeah, sunscreen's super important, though. Never, ever go out without sunscreen. I got a second degree burn on my face, so.
Hey, whoa.
Yeah. But it all healed.
Yeah. You look fine now.
Thank you.
So what's next?
So what's next is that we've now completed almost half the season in the K&N West Series, and so I am sponsored by Toyota and Napa Filters, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And Toyota
did you talk to them?
So how do you get that sponsorship?
Yes.
What's that like?
So that sponsorship was interesting. They had a relationship with the team I drive for, Bill McAnally Racing, and Bill's a great guy, and so he said, you know, Toyota's interested in sponsoring you. Do you want to come out and test for them? I did. They signed on, and now so I've been developing that relationship with Toyota specifically and talk with them and, you know, looking ahead to next next year. We're not sure yet, but you know, ideally we would race the East Coast version of the K&N series. Right now I'm on the West Coast, but you know, it's really exciting. We're looking, you know, becoming very brand conscious. And back in May, I was selected for the NASCAR Next program, which is a really exclusive program where NASCAR executives, their drivers council, and different media outlets nominate drivers to be part of this program. So there were 11 drivers selected. I was the only female, and they basically, it's a very public statement that NASCAR supports us and they expect us to be future stars of the sport. So with that, we've been able to go to a lot of outlets, a lot of PR areas, and just really push the brand, the, you know, New York City educated, competent women empowerment STEM advocate brand that I have. And that's how we're kind of narrowing down our outreach for sponsorship for the following coming years.
But wow. Be certain of this. When you say that NASCAR supports us or that Toyota supports us, it's you.
Right.
It's your skill.
Sorry, yes, it's me. I've gotten used to the, you know, the
team.
Plural,
yeah,
team,
exactly.
Aspect. Yeah, but they, NASCAR is supporting me as a driver.
Exactly. If you sucked, you'd be in.
I wouldn't be there, right?
I missed it by
exactly.
one again.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, so it was, last year was a really great year with the championship. It showed that, you know, it was my first full season out of college, and so to show that I've still got it was really cool. And
what do you mean still got it? You're like a kid.
racing
so
young.
You don't lose
until
you're like 42.
Racing is so young. I'm competing against 16 and 17 year olds.
Really? Seriously?
At 24, I'm, you know, getting up there. So.
Yeah, I can tell that.
So, Jeffrey, you
As
must...
I said to my 25-year-old underwear.
That's awesome.
Oh, man. All right. So when we had lunch a few weeks back, you were talking about your speaking career. How did you get that off the ground?
Yeah. So originally, when I started college, I knew that I had... that I could be a role model for people, and especially girls. And so I started off by just volunteering my time to go speak with girls' camps, girls' science camps in the Bay Area, and just started that way and really enjoyed it, and I felt that I got a lot from it. But then when I was a senior, I was asked to do a Stanford TEDx discussion.
Whoa.
And so I was like, whoa, okay, they think I have something cool to say. So I put together a talk on, it was an 8-minute talk like a TEDx. And so it was talking about stereotypes against women that we can fight. Can
our listeners find this online?
Oh, yeah. If you go to YouTube and search, can nice girls win races, you'll find it. It's a lot of fun. And so once I did that, I was like, wow, I can make an audience laugh. That is really cool. And I had a lot of fun and got the adrenaline rush, similar to racing. And so then I started, that's a different kind of sale. I started pitching myself that way. And I started, my first paid speaking gig was to an all-girls school in New York and motivating their high school middle school students. I was like, wow, I can get paid to get people to laugh.
Exactly.
This is so cool.
You should be speaking at graduations.
That's what I would love to do. And I've spoken at some universities and various associations. And so it's something that, you know, I push pretty heavily. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm developing more of a talk around fear. So I've had some tips for success and more women's focused talks. But this idea of fear is so interesting because everyone's scared of something. And so being able to harness it and really use it to your advantage is so empowering. So to be able to kind of work on that, it's a work in progress still, but I'm really excited for it.
So let's make a deal here on the air. We will be your speech coach in exchange for just a minor sponsorship thing, like put us by the doorknob.
All right, we can talk about that. You bet.
Jeffrey will also take 3 laps around Bristol.
Oh, yeah, no, so let me tell you something. I did the Richard Petty experience in Daytona.
Oh, boy, that's a big track.
Is there a video of this?
I don't know. I don't think so. Let me tell you what. The first lap, and we've talked about this briefly, some guy gets in the car. He's not like it wasn't like Richard Petty, rest his soul. But it wasn't Jeff Gordon. It was just some guy. And all of a sudden, he's driving 160 miles an hour down the straightaway.
Mm-hmm.
And we bank this turn, and I feel like I'm going to... And my stomach is like literally like just inching up my throat, and you can feel the G-forces. You're in a suit. You're strapped in. You can hardly move. And I was... I wasn't peeing in my pants, but I was real close.
I'm glad you made me tell that.
If you make me feel better, I have peed in my pants in the car. So.
Oh, cool. Well, there you go.
You wouldn't be the first.
Misconfession.
I feel like that might be a common thing.
Yeah. It can't be uncomfortable.
So by the second lap, I was actually almost comfortable. And the guy looked at me as we're finishing, as we're going into the third lap, and he's like, gives me the are you okay signal. I went like this.
What does that mean?
Which I like
pedal
put your hand
to the
down.
Floor.
Like, put the pedal down, Bub. I want to feel what it really feels like. And let me tell you what, he burnt it. And
I bet.
When we banked, and I'm like leaning out the window, but I figured I don't think this was it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to the Richard Petty experience.
I was just
going to
ask, are you going to do it again?
No. They haul your ass out of the car. They, like, pull you out of the window.
I'll be honest. I wouldn't want to be a passenger in one of those things.
Yeah, there's a difference between having the control and driving the car and then sitting back and hoping you're going to live.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. And no, I'm glad you probably didn't notice while you were out there, but when you're right side, you're way closer to the wall if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Not to scare all the listeners, but that's something that as a driver, I was like, ooh, I'm not sure I could do that. But
it was an experience.
Yeah.
And that's, they call it the Richard Petty experience. I went with a group of people. Mm-hmm. There was probably 50 people that went around the track that day, and they kept like vroom, vroom, vroom. I wanted to get first. I wanted to be like, so I was like one of the first three or four people to do it. I wanted it to be out of the way. I didn't want the guy to have fatigue or whatever the deal was. I wanted him fresh, and it was fun. It really was fun. But when it's done, oh boy, are you happy.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot on your body, too. I think people don't understand how physical it is, and what the G-forces are like, what the heat's like. You know, the motor's right there, so it can be 130 degrees in the car. So, I mean, you got to be fit to do it for a while, for sure.
I can only imagine.
So you're gonna go give more speeches this year? Will you be speaking more?
Yeah. We've got a couple lined up for the fall. During the season's a little harder just because my travel schedule's so wacky. But
do you have an agent?
I do have an agent. I work with an agent. I also have my manager. And so, I'm getting all kind of fancy big time here.
Sweetie, this is amazing.
Yeah. So, and you know, it's a slow takeoff, but it's getting there and it's really cool and it's, you know, it's sustainable, so that's exciting.
Have you found parallels in crafting a good speech and in driving?
Oh, yeah. It's super interesting, right? So with a talk, I have found when I've listened to other speakers that I lose a speaker if their transitions aren't good, if they just kind of jump from point to point. And so this idea of the transitions and hitting your marks and having this smooth transition from point to point is the same thing on a racetrack. You can't be abrupt. You need to kind of go. So in terms of a flow, there's that. And then practice, preparation. I mean, I'm sure you guys know when you practice a talk, it's over and over and over again. It's hours a day. You're giving like a 45-minute talk or an hour or something. You just got to dedicate that time.
When I gave my first talk, I was surprised how much I actually needed to prepare to do a really good job. So for a 2-hour talk, I may have prepped 20 hours behind the scenes.
I mean, my 8-minute talk for TEDx had weeks of preparation. I probably wasn't the most efficient back then, but I mean, it was so many hours.
Yeah. You get the jitters?
Yeah, you get the butterflies. If I don't, like, same with racing, if I don't have butterflies right before I go out, I'm not on edge enough. I'm not there mentally. So that's a very good indicator for me that I'm ready to go.
You're ready.
That's interesting. I think, though, that as your speaking career evolves and you come up with, Julia's juice for your talk, and you'll have, like, 10 things that men do that women should be doing, 10 things that women do that men just stay the hell out of it. And then there's got to be a couple girly things in there that you have to, no matter what, you got to look good.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's a fascinating thing. It's interesting being a racer also. Like, you see all the guys who, like, they just kind of show up at the track, and there are different expectations for women. So, like, in terms of appearance, and they're asking me, can I do stuff with my hair? And I get out of the car, and it's like I just showered. I mean, there's so much sweat, and you're in a helmet. It's like, what do you want me to do? So trying to find that balance. But
while you're drinking milk and stuff?
They definitely interview me afterwards, and you know, I look like any athlete who just got done with a competition. Sweaty and red and a little wired because you're still digesting everything.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So have you developed your own sales tips for yourself that you want to share with some of the people that are?
Yeah, definitely. There are a couple of things. Authenticity, not giving a potential, you know, a sale recipient what they want to hear, but it's really kind of being really true as to what you offer, how you can offer it. I think the ability to have a discussion and negotiate is really good. You know, I have found that when I go to potential sponsors, you know, we give the price point that's our start off point, and a lot of times that'll scare people. And so really saying, okay, if you want to work together, we can make this work. So this back and forth, which works for me, it may not work for everyone in sales, but it works for me. And then being persistent. I mean, there are some people who I really want to get in touch with, and if I don't have a connection to them, like, I'll email them once, and if they don't respond, I'll email again, and then I'll call and, like, make sure they really don't want to talk to me before I give up.
I love that. That's great.
No shame. That's a huge part. I'm sure you guys know that. That's the other thing. Just, like, in general in life, no time for shame.
I don't know. I've been shamed a lot when I was a kid.
So no shame, persistence, and authenticity.
Yeah, I think that's great. A great way. Yeah.
Cool. All right, Julia, thanks again for joining us. You can learn more about Julia at her website, Julia Landauer, that's LANDAUER.com, and follow her on Twitter at Julia Landauer. We're going to say goodbye to Julia.
Oh,
I know.
This is so fun.
I know. This is like too short. You have to come back. But while we do that, here's a short word from Jeffrey on having the courage to face failure.
It's important to understand and to remember that fear of failure doesn't exist if you believe it doesn't. You will be rejected. So what? The prospect will reject your offer. Big deal. Attitude, humor, and action or persistence will whip fears and rejection. Edison, Lincoln, Babe Ruth, Colonel Sanders, these guys failed miserably thousands of times. Where would they be without their attitude to succeed? And where would we be without their successes? You only fail when you quit. Here's a couple things to consider. Set your own goals for achievement. How many calls per day? How many appointments per day? Selling is not just numbers. It's smart numbers. But they will only work if you are prepared. You must work your numbers consistently to get them to pay. You got to push yourself to win. And consider your objectives and your purpose. If you cold call enough people, you will make appointments. That's your objective. And you will make sales. That's your purpose. Here's a solid tip. Visualize it happening. Seeing is believing. Believing is the first step to achieving. It's easier to do what you can see. Visualizing success helps eliminate fear of the unknown. Recreate those visual pictures with your words when you talk to the prospect. Here's your goal. Every time you go through a door, get what you came for. Know what your objective is for the cold call. Close the prospect on the next step in your sales cycle. The biggest fear isn't making the call. It's asking for the sale. Focus on asking and push for it till you get it. Here's a few asks that work. Which will be better for you? Who should I? If I would you, when can I? The best technique I can give you about the cold call? It's a big game. Have fun and play to win, baby. Play to win. So welcome back to Sell or Die. We just had an amazing interview and a great conversation with Julia Landauer. If you are listening live and missed any of that conversation, what were you thinking? Make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your favorite channel is so that you can listen back to this or any episode anytime you want. Jen, what did you find most fascinating about what Julia had to say?
You know, I never knew there was so much selling involved with racing. And the fact that it's half racing and half talent, but also half raising money and branding yourself.
Which is its own talent.
Exactly. And pitching and getting these multi-million dollar sponsorships.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible to me. I mean, that's two different talents.
We're going to get our logo on that car no matter what, because Julia is going to the moon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's definitely headed for the stars. And she's, I mean,
we're going to be on that
ride. Hang on a second. Think about what you were doing when you were 24 years old.
Uh-huh.
You were out hustling someplace. You were, you know, trying to feel your oats. This chick's riding 150 miles an hour down the track. It's unbelievable.
And she has hundreds of thousands of fans.
Yeah.
Who
want to see her win.
Who want to see her succeed. Yeah. And many of them are looking up to her as a role model.
So I want to throw something at you. And, you know, in every sport, they have the people that sort of go over the top with their personality and they act kind of like jackassy. She's a nice person.
Well, she said it. It's all about being authentic. She's herself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she's not putting on some kind of show.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so she knows her way around a race car and she knows her way around a racetrack, but she also knows herself. And how important is that for salespeople to know your product, but also Know yourself and brand yourself.
She's a grounded woman.
Belief in yourself is the most important thing you can have as a salesperson. Mm-hmm.
And once you get a couple of wins under your belt, you're not afraid to step on the gas a little bit. And it's the same in sales. The best time to make a sale is when you just made one.
Exactly.
I mean, that's like, you know.
Yeah. But here's the fatal flaw. A lot of salespeople make a sale and they're like, yes, I made a sale. I'm going to take the afternoon off. Let's go golfing.
Yeah.
Let's go wherever, you know, hang out. Let's celebrate over a beer at lunch. No, you just made a sale. Go make another.
It never ceases to amaze me what people don't do when it's their most opportune time.
Yeah.
And whether it's getting up in the morning and writing or walking your 10,000 steps on your Fitbit every day, whatever it is that you're in the habit.
You can up it to 12,000. It doesn't have
to
be 10,000.
I can, but I'm not going to. And the challenge that you face as a salesperson is that consistency. And if you have the consistency and you're willing to dedicate some time to it, you're going to win. Julia was here to talk about what her dedication was. I don't think we have any idea the work ethic that she really has.
No, because, you know, she didn't even talk about, she has to work out every day and prep for being, she doesn't just jump in the car and go around the racetrack.
Really? From the parking lot? No, she's definitely got the discipline. You can just sense it when you're with her.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going now. We're going to talk about who's next. We have a great conversation coming up in just moments with my good friend Mark Jackson from Illinois University, playing football all the way to Charlotte, North Carolina, selling sports tickets for the Hornets. But first, I want to tell you about the future of sales training. You can find it on the Gittimer Learning Academy, but you can also find it at jeffreygittimer.com/gold/mastery. And you can find all of the information that you need to succeed. Now, the great Jim Rohn once said, everything you need to succeed already exists. All the information that you need to succeed already exists. Problem is, you're not exposing yourself to it.
So on jeffreygittimer.com/mastery, they can get your sales assessment and certification.
Oh.
Yeah.
How come I didn't know that?
I don't know.
Oh. Jeffrey Gittimer. So what we did is we created a sales assessment, so you as a salesperson can know exactly where you are at this moment in time.
Okay, so I fill out the sales assessment. What do I get?
You get a 40-page report to tell you where you are in your own rating and how you rate against all the other salespeople that have ever taken the certification. It's really cool.
That is cool.
I refer to it as a sales selfie, but really what it is it's your present circumstance, your skill level, and your ability to get to the next level, because I'm not going to just tell you what you answered, but why you answered it that way and how you can get better at it, even if you got it wrong.
Cool. Okay, so jeffreygittimer.com/mastery.
I got that.
Okay. I want to make sure our listeners got that.
I got it.
Okay.
jeffreygittimer.com/mastery.
Oh, yeah.
On it.
All right. So we can move on, I guess. Sports and entertainment can be an exciting entry point for young salespeople, but it can also be very challenging. We sat down with Mark Jackson, Vice President of Ticket Sales for the NBA's Charlotte Hornets, to discuss how young salespeople can overcome the early challenges and use their first selling experiences to launch their careers. Take a listen.
These are oftentimes recent graduates, passionate about this industry, passionate about this business, passionate about their career, starting it, learning and growing so that they can create something of themselves. And so, we have a great group of sellers, young sellers. We've got some people that have been there a few weeks. We've got some people that have been there a few years. And I think the common denominator with our department is people often ask, well, tell me a little bit about it. I would say it is professionally aggressive.
And I'm going to modify just a little bit. They're assertive, but not too aggressive. This is Charlotte, North Carolina. You can't be too aggressive or people go, hey, you sound like you're from New York. But these are young people that come from all over the country. I make them go around the room and explain and tell me who their favorite sports team is, because if any of them are from Boston, I immediately jump on them.
Yeah, I've seen one or two get heckled before.
Exactly. And I'm from Philadelphia myself, so I deserve heckling, but we expect it, so it's no problem. I mean, you know, we have four sports teams in Philadelphia. They all suck. But our basketball team, you know, hey, Villanova, we know what to do when we get into the Final Four. Occasionally we win. And we won very unexpectedly.
Very unexpectedly. But, I mean, it's good to see some shakeup every once in a while.
Yeah. So today I want to talk about why do people buy tickets? And I think more importantly, how do they use them? What's the best use that they can make of those tickets? Because tickets are not cheap anymore. You know, a good ticket's $100, $150. Cheap tickets are $30. So if you take four people to a game, you're going to spend a couple $100 anyway, maybe $250 by the time you get there and get back and park, have a few beers, and have a overpriced hot dog. How much are hot dogs? $9?
I think they're around $6.
Okay. Huh, cheap. Give me two. But the challenge is, are you having a good time? So my three main categories for buying tickets are for business, for family, and for friends. And the key to this is finding out why that customer wants to buy to begin with. Rather than tell a guy, hey, this is perfect for business, and the guy didn't really care about his business, I want to find out why first. Don't you?
I would agree. I would agree absolutely. Because in those three categories, they encompass everything. I mean, we actually have a document that we make our rep study, which is called the 99 uses for tickets. Mm-hmm. And all 99 of those fall into one of those buckets. And you're absolutely right. The fact that motive is the most important factor that you need to uncover so that you can make a recommendation.
And
that
you can
makes
have
sense.
A conversation with them.
100%.
I mean, absolutely. The guy's going to stop listening. If you say, well, let me give you the three areas where people buy tickets, like, I don't want a lesson. I want a ticket. And I want to find out, tell me about the last time you went to a game. Who did you go with? Wow. Is that why you usually go to games? Now, with two questions, I can find out I want to know if they have kids, because taking a kid to his first game, that's everything.
It's special.
For a dad or mom. I also want to find out if he's a single guy dating somebody that he wants to bring to the game. It's a social event, especially at the Hornets. There's plenty to do socially.
Yeah, absolutely. Our events team, they do a great job. So it's more than just a game. Obviously, the game is the focal point, and that is the main attraction. But there's a lot of stuff that's going on during timeouts, before the game, after the game, on the concourse and whatnot. And so there be a number of different reasons, motive essentially, why people are coming to games. And that's one thing that you absolutely have to figure out during your conversation.
Are they going to bring a customer, a kid, or a girlfriend? Are they going to bring a wife or their best buddies? Who are they going to bring to the game? Doug, for example, our amazing producer, is like one of the biggest Hornets fans on the planet. He does a blog and a podcast called Hive Talk Live, which has zillions of visitors, but he brings his wife to every game, correct?
Yeah, I bring my wife to every game.
You bring your wife to every game, okay. And what's the value of that?
It has single-handedly kept our marriage alive.
Wow, cool. All
right. No, it's good. It gives us a chance. You know, we work 8 hours a day apart from one another, and so for 41 nights, we get to spend 2 hours together watching, you know, sharing an experience. So that's definitely helpful.
But it's sharing an experience that you both like. Sometimes wives don't like basketball games, so you go with your buddies. But 41 games with your wife, that's pretty cool. Plus playoffs, right?
Plus yeah. playoffs, yeah. Absolutely. It's very cool. It's one, it's live drama,
mm-hmm.
and it is your time. That can be your time. For you and your wife.
So motive is not just in sports tickets. Motive is anywhere you go to sell, isn't it? I want to find out why they want to buy. Because if I know why people want to buy and you only know how to sell, I'll beat you every time. The most interesting thing to me is that no one asks why. It's the dumbest thing on the planet. At one time, I was a very big collector of autographs. And I would go to sports shows and buy autographs. And the sports guy, the dealer, the autograph dealer, is there pretty much just for the hell of it. You know, they have these autographs and they're in business and it's like a cash deal, whatever. And I'll go up to a Will Chamberlain autograph because he's like my, you know, my basketball Jesus, if there is one. He's my guy. And I go, how much is this Will Chamberlain autograph? And the guy says, it's $200, but you can have it for $150. I said, all right, I'll take it. I go to the next guy and I say, how much is this Will Chamberlain autograph? He goes, it's $200. I said, well, what's your best price? He said, well, I'll give it to you $150. I said, okay, I'll take it. And I go to the third guy and I say, how much is this autograph? And he says, it's $200. I said, okay, but what's your best price? He goes, it's $200. I said, all right, I'll take it. Now, every single one of those guys was incorrect because none of them said, why do you want this Will Chamberlain autograph? I said, well, when I was a kid, I went to summer camp and Wilt came to our summer camp to play. And I sent a postcard home to my mom and dad. I said, dear mom and dad, I played basketball with Wilt the Stilt today. He signed this postcard. Please save it. Love, Jeff. And my mom saved the autograph for 25 years. So if my place is burning down, the first thing I'm going to do is grab that autograph and run out the door, and the rest Chubb Insurance will take care of. Okay. Now, if the guy would have asked me that and I would have told him that story, he would have said, listen, normally this autograph is $200, but for you, $500. Take it or leave it.
And you probably would have bought it.
Oh, yeah, take it. I'll take it. Yeah, $400. All right, $400. I'll take it. But they never even want to know why. They're idiots.
It's the most powerful thing that you can do is figure out why.
If you can figure out why, they will buy from you. You don't have to sell them. They will buy from you. I'm amazed at how poorly people execute. If you go into a department store, they want to sell you a shirt. They don't want to ask where you're going to wear it. They don't want to say who you're going to go to the ball game with. They don't want to say, it's nothing. I'm going to a basketball game tonight. It's feeling important that I look good. Let me show you what just came in. Like, that's my opportunity to either upsell or sell more, you know. So if I know that this guy wants to buy these tickets for his family, okay, how many are in your family? Well, I have three daughters. So now I know it's a five-ticket sale. It's not a four-ticket sale. And if I don't know that, I'm going to say, well, we have a special. You know, if you buy four tickets, you can. And the guy's already thinking, no, I need five. They didn't ask the question.
Not only that, but you can even go even further. So he's coming to the ball game with his family. He's got three daughters. Well, okay, well, where do your daughters like to watch the game from? Where do you like to watch the game from?
Mm-hmm.
What type of experience are you looking for?
Exactly. The more you know, the easier it is for you to get them to buy. You don't have to sell at that point in time. If they're interested and they want to make it a family deal, they will buy. The only question is how many. Will they buy a season ticket that they want, you know? And if they say, well, that's 41 is too many games for me, I'll say, well, a lot of people think that, but normally it's not enough tickets. What do you mean? Well, you're in business, correct? Yeah. How many customers do you have? Oh, like 300. Well, so in other words, you're going to have to decide who goes to these games, correct? How many employees do you have? Well, 70. So this is going to be a lottery deal. This is not going to be like, and now now this guy has a better understanding of total ticket use.
And you get to walk them through that, which is actually enjoyable part, whereas where you actually get to build a game plan, mm-hmm. except for your customers so that they can have a complete total program for their ticket usage.
I think that there is an opportunity for any salesperson to engage deeper by asking questions. And I don't, you know, don't think to yourself, well, I don't sell sports tickets. This show is not for me. That's bullshit. This show is for you because we're trying to talk about motive to buy. And for the most part, you don't even know. If a customer calls you up and says, I want to buy X, you never ask them why they want to buy X. You just start to go into your X mode and say, well, we have a special today. There's 3 for $2 or 2 for $5. I don't want a special. And so here's the classic example. I go into Home Depot and I said, listen, I need a drill. And the guy said, well, let me show you where the drills are because this is on sale. He goes, if the guy had a half of a brain, he would go, you don't need a drill. You need a hole. What do you mean? Well, what are you going to do with the drill when you get home? Look at it? No, I'm going to drill a hole. Okay, so what kind of hole? What else can I sell you that goes in the hold? You need studs. You need a picture hook. You need
what's going in the hold?
Bingo.
The first thing is what's going in the hold.
What's going in the hold? That's correct. So I don't want an answer to my question. I want a solution to my problem.
Yes, 100%. That is the key that is lost 90% of the time.
Were you a sports athlete?
I was in college. I played football at the University of Illinois.
Does that help you in your sales pitch? Do you feel like athletics has helped you significantly?
It helps me because being an athlete, there are certain things that you need to do. You need to become a student of the game. You need to take ownership of being an athlete and the process to be successful. And I think the same applies in our industry, regardless of whether it's sports or any type of sales. You need to take ownership of the process and what's required to be successful, like understanding all aspects of why people are going to buy.
That's correct. But you're also, as an athlete, you're coachable. Also, as an athlete, you want to win. Also, as an athlete, you're in shape. And I think all of those things come together because I've noticed all the kids at there's no fatty sitting at the table at the Hornets.
Well, that's not part of the recruiting process.
No, I understand that, but they're all kids that are on fire.
Oftentimes,
lot of them are either athletes or just love sports in general.
I would say they're active. Oftentimes, almost all of them, I would say 99% of them are active in some form or fashion.
Yeah. And that helps as a salesperson. Absolutely. So if you find somebody who's a fan, you find somebody who's smart, you find somebody who can ask questions.
You find someone that wants to learn and has a passion for learning and growing.
Great conversation with Mark, who's having a lot of success with the Charlotte Hornets right now. Jeffrey, you're about to go speak to some young salespeople in professional baseball.
I love speaking to young people selling sports tickets because it's something that they can identify with and something that they have done themselves. They bought a ticket. They've been to a ballgame with their dad or their mom, and they love a team. Mm-hmm. And if the team that they love happens to be the team that they're selling for, they're going to double love the team, and they're going to have a little bit of courage to go out and make the sale. Now, I've told – excuse me. I've been training the Charlotte Hornets for 7 or 8 years. They were the Bobcats. They were the Hornets, whatever. I've also trained a bunch of other teams and spoken at a lot of sporting event sales, ticket sales programs. And yes, I'm going to go speak to one in another week or two. They're selling sweet luxury suites. But I tell these people that this is not a job. It's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And the way they look at this is they're going to have an opportunity. They're not going to work there for 20 years. They're going to work there for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then they're going to go to another thing, whatever their dad's business or some other career path or whatever. And some will stay, but most will go. And it's a measure of how they've achieved at this time. They have to realize they're not kids anymore. They're not going to go drink beer till 3 o'clock in the morning. They're not going to party. They got to get up and go to work. And this is an incredible opportunity for them to put their feet on the ground and make some money.
Their career.
Bingo. For many of them. So you got some questions out there in listener land. Come on. I want to have some burning sales questions from you listeners and users of reddit.com/r/sales. Who's next, Douglas?
All right. Next up is R. Wainick, who writes, I'm having a hard time distinguishing when a prospect really isn't a good fit versus when I simply didn't do a good job on the phone. How can you tell the difference?
It's an easy way to tell. They buy. Like, okay, I'll take it.
No, but what he's saying is, like, they don't buy. So are they just not a good fit? Or did he suck?
Listen to the recording. If you're on the phone with somebody, record every minute. Go home at night and listen to how good or how bad you are. Once you do that and do it every day for a month, you're going to start to get better almost automatically. Most salespeople go home and they drink a beer. No, you go home and listen to what you said.
Okay, I want to add something to that. Take notes. Take notes on the things that you want to improve and hold that paper with you and concentrate on improving those things on your next call.
That's correct, but let me just challenge you for this. Yes, I want you to take notes, but I want you to listen to how you sound. And try to autocorrect the next time. Try to put yourself in a position where it becomes automatic, Now, we talked about this one time before. I did the same thing. When I first started, I watched a video of mine. I took a page of notes, and I carried the notes with me for 3 years. So I definitely recommend that you take notes. But I more recommend that you listen to your voice and feel your energy, feel your authenticity, feel the things that are moving you to the next level, and realize, okay, you made a sale, record that one. You didn't make a sale, record that one. Then listen to the difference. And mm-hmm. It's amazing. You'll find your energy level, your authenticity, the way you ask somebody, or the way you just cave in when the guy says, well, I'm not really interested. And when the guy says, I'm not really interested, it means you're not interesting. But you blame the other guy. The other guy wouldn't return my call. The guy hung up on me. It's not the guy.
They said it's too expensive.
Yeah, it's not the guy.
Is there any such thing as a prospect that's not a good fit? And can you tell
sure,
that
tons
over
of
the
them.
Phone?
It's harder to tell on the
over
phone,
the phone's
Doug.
Hard.
Yeah.
But if you're getting a call list, it's likely that the person who came up with that list has targeted these individuals and believe that they're a good fit.
But let me throw this at you. You can ask the prospect a question of how have they successfully used your product in the past? What have they done with it? Why do they like it? Why do they recommend it? And that will give you more of an insight. And once you get that, you can transfer it to other people. These guys are selling the same thing all the time. It's a ticket, or it's a vacuum cleaner, or it's a real estate piece, whatever it is. It's the same thing, and it's repetitive. Mm-hmm. You develop that set of questions that you ask, and all of a sudden it becomes deeper.
All right, next up, this person must be in pharmacy sales. Their username is Kim Peddler, and Kim Peddler wants
like
to know
that.
About... Yeah, it's all these usernames are amazing. Kim Peddler wants to know about how to deal with a prospect who overshares political opinions with the Brexit and U.S. elections, all kinds of action on social issues. What are some best practices and rules of thumb if you ever find yourself cornered by a political prospect?
Or a religious prospect.
Yeah.
The best thing to do is exit professionally. Wow, that's a really great topic. And oftentimes I talk about that, but usually not at work.
Okay. Would you add humor?
No,
in terms of your exit.
I probably add my political views.
That's a minefield right there.
No, I don't mean add humor to respond to their political views, but in terms of your exit.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, you can.
A rabbi, a priest, and a walking
dead. Yeah. Exactly. But I think that you have to put yourself in a position where you can... You realize that you can piss somebody off in 3 seconds mm-hmm. with the wrong viewpoint.
I mean, we mentioned something on one episode that was like not even really that political, and we had all sorts of comments.
Like vote Republican or something. I forget what it was. But I think that if you put yourself in a position where you are going to listen to it, then you have an option of trying to figure out, do I want to engage this guy? By saying, why do you feel that way, or what caused you to feel that way? But I don't want to give my opinion.
Right. Yeah, I don't bring up my opinion ever on political stuff because I'm going to piss half the people off.
Yeah. Hopefully slightly less when it comes to the election. But yes.
All right, we only have a few more.
It's going to be close.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes, or really only a minute for this one. So real quickly, Fender Maniac asks, have you ever had a prospect where you were not getting anywhere with them, but going to their superior led to unblocking a potential deal?
Sure.
Pissing them off.
Well, if you're dealing with an underling who's not really a decision maker, you have to make a choice of, do I want to go around this guy? And normally what I would do is ask the guy to bring in the decision maker to the conversation so he or she doesn't feel left out.
Yeah.
That's the most strategic way. But sometimes somebody won't return calls. You call their daddy.
Yeah, but I think he's saying they're returning the calls and you're not getting anywhere. And
it's because they're not the decision maker.
I agree. You say, okay, let's have a 3-way meeting with you, me, and Moneybags.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again for all those questions. If you didn't hear your question, make sure to submit it again next week to Twitter, Facebook, or email us.
And the week after that.
Any week, all day long, at sellordie@gittimer.com.
And make sure to subscribe. Come on, you guys. Just subscribe to us on
iTunes.
You
know, five stars.
Oh.
Subscribe and hit the 5-star.
I don't want to beg for ratings. You do whatever you want. But if you don't hit the 5-star, don't come back. You can subscribe to us on whatever you use to get your podcasts. Just search for Sell or Die and re-listen. I mean, this is something you can listen to again and again. I feel like we're interesting enough. We're certainly boosting our listenership literally weekly. Tell one of your friends. Tell both your friends. We're trying to get our listeners up to 100,000 a week.
So thanks for listening to the Sell or Die podcast. We're back live next week at our regular time, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern time. Bookmark blogtalkradio.com/sell or die and come join the conversation that's revolutionizing sales podcasting.
And thank you to our guests, the great Julia Landauer and Mark Jackson. Our producer is the amazing and talented Doug Branson, and our technical director is Mr. Push the Button himself, Chris Hill.
Until next time, I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, reminding you to get out there and sell until your ass falls off.